Hello, I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Men's Monday, we focus on all things for and about men. Welcome to this rebroadcast of a special two-part program from the Mind Talk Library. As we enter into Black History Month, I thought it useful to share this important piece of political history with you. Hope you enjoy. Let me introduce you to today's guest. His name is Abraham Bolden. And Abraham Bolden is the author of a memoir entitled The Echo from Dealey Plaza. And this book is described as the true story of the first African American on the White House Secret Service detail and his quest for justice after the assassination of JFK. Abraham Bolden, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you very much, Pamela, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, your story is a chilling one on many levels. You were the first African American on the White House Secret Service. So, you know, what one would like to think about that is that this was a wonderful thing and a wonderful time in your life. And I think it was. Did you, from a little one growing up, have aspirations to work in the government service?
Yes, I had aspirations to. Actually, I wanted to be a lawyer when I was growing up, but I became a very efficient musician on the trumpet, and I received a scholarship to Lincoln University. But I had always had a great respect for the law. I lived in the vicinity of two policemen when I was growing up in East St. Louis, Illinois, and they made quite an impression upon me because of the service that they were performing. So I wanted to emulate them in so many ways and found that I was very interested in trying to find a solution to many of the injustices that I had seen prevalent in my hometown.
And so tell us how you got from your hometown to Washington, D.C. in the service of President Kennedy. How did that happen?
Well, I pursued a direction in police work soon after I graduated from Lincoln University in 1956.
Okay.
And yes, I have a BA in music composition. And I followed music simply because that was the way I financed my way through college. So after I graduated, I had to make a decision as to what type of occupation I wanted to go in. I had two offers. One was a music teacher in Southern Missouri, and the other one was to go into the Pinkerton National Detective Agency as the first Black detective in that division. And so I chose to go into the Pinkerton National Detective Agency as the first African-American detective hired by Pinkerton.
Now, you know, those two options seem to be so far apart. One as a musician teaching music, the other one as a detective. How did both of those offers come to be? Or are they far apart? As I hear them, one sounds very different from the other in terms of skills, interest, expertise.
Yes, they are. They are somewhat diverse. Now, by my being a musician for so many years, I was of the impression that being a musician was very glorious and it was inviting and you were in the public eye. But the thing about it, I found out that being a musician was very difficult. There was a lot of travel involved, and I had a family early in my career. And that didn't quite jive with, you might say, the traveling around that I would have had to do in order to be a successful musician. So I wanted something more stable.
Okay.
And my second option was to the Pinkerton National Detective Agency. And I was the first African-American detective for that agency.
And how was that for you, being the first?
It was wonderful with Pinkerton. It was wonderful. I had an opportunity to get an idea about police enforcement, even though that we were involved mostly in civil matters. It gave me a good training. They gave me a good opportunity to actually experience being a policeman, and I enjoyed it very much, and I was treated very respectfully, even though there were a few agents there. I was, you know, being in St. Louis, Missouri at the particular time. There was some racism going on during that time, but I was able to successfully complete 1 year of service with Pinkerton before I went into the Illinois State Police in 1957.
What kind of cases did you work on with Pinkerton? Was it a range, or did you develop a specialty?
Well, we did a range of cases. We did insurance investigations where we would photograph people who were, say, for instance, had a suit in for damages in some insurance matter.
Mm-hmm.
And we also did store detective work. And we also did transportation inspection work, that is, riding on buses and making sure that all of the laws of the travel, interstate commerce, were being observed by the driver. These are the type of operations that we did. Also, undercover work in restaurants, in hotels, and things to find out whether or not people were indeed engaged in the activity in which they were employed.
Okay, so it was really a range of cases that you actually covered.
Yes, it was.
Now, you moved from Pinkerton and your career was progressing. How did you wind up at the White House?
Well, I wound up at the White House after serving 4 years with the Illinois State Police, beginning in 1957. President Kennedy came to Peoria, Illinois, where I was stationed, and I got a chance to look at the president as a candidate. He was a candidate senator, a candidate for president of the United States, and I was a state trooper there in Peoria where he was coming to give a speech, you know, a speech to the politicians and to the people of Peoria. And he impressed me very much. So while I was there, I had an opportunity to meet a Secret Service agent. And I asked the Secret Service agent, who was a special in charge of the Springfield office, whether or not they in fact had Negro agents in the Secret Service. He indicated to me that they may have been, but he wasn't sure and asked me to apply for a position, and that's what I did.
Okay.
And on October the 30th of 1960, I became a United States Secret Service agent.
What a day for you. I mean,
yes.
that was huge.
It was huge.
And so for you and for your family, you, on that day, October 30th, 1960, you had accomplished something wonderful and amazing, and your entire life, certainly your professional life, wasn't going to go anywhere but up, and it was all in front of you.
Yes, that's right. That's what I thought. I sure did. And after the president won the presidency, President Kennedy became president after winning the election in November of 1960, I had been transferred to Chicago as an agent of the United States Secret Service. So in my duties as a Secret Service agent, the president was coming to Chicago on April the 28th of 1961 for a political dinner at McCormick Place. Now, normally the agents who are stationed in the city where the president is to be traveling, also participates in his protection.
Okay.
And yes, in that relationship, I was posted in front of a restroom, which was on the lower level of McCormick Place, out of the way from which the president was supposed to be seen. Now, the thing about that was I noticed right away that they moved my post, which I had originally been scheduled, and which was upstairs near the door where the president was going to pass. They took me from there, put me downstairs, and put a Chicago policeman upstairs near the proximity of the president.
Was that unusual?
Well, beg your pardon?
Was that unusual? Were you concerned
yes,
about
that?
That?
Very, okay. That was very unusual because they usually tried to place the uniformed policeman in positions where he would be easily recognizable.
I see.
Here in this instance, you had me in plain clothes, and I had my button on, and I was telling people that they could not use that particular restroom, and as a young African American standing there, there was some very disgruntled attitudes mm-hmm. of me directing those people who wanted to use the washroom to another direction, and so that would not have occurred had the uniformed policeman been standing there.
Gotcha.
Now, yes, and so, but the president was running a little late for the reception, and as fate would have it, at 8:30 o'clock on April 28, 1961, as the motorcade pulled up in front of McCormick Place, I saw the lights flashing upstairs, and I really wanted to get a chance to see the president of the United States, but from my location, that was an impossibility. So, but as fate would have it, once the motorcade stopped, the first thing that the president wanted to do was use the washroom, and there I stood. So he came down the steps, followed by every dignitary in the state of Illinois in Cook County. And as he came down the steps, he was smiling. They were taking pictures and everything. And just before he walked into the washroom, he stopped right in front of me. And he looked me in the eye, and he smiled, and he extended his hands, and I shook hands with the president. And he asked me, he said, "Are you a Secret Service agent, or are you one of Mayor Daley's finest," meaning a Chicago policeman.
Okay.
And I told him, "I'm a Secret Service agent, Mr. President." And the president, during the conversation, asked me whether or not they had any Negro Secret Service agents on the White House detail in Washington, D.C. And I answered, "Not to my knowledge, Mr. President." And the president looked me straight in the eye, and he smiled. What a wonderful smile he had.
Mm.
And he said, "Would you like to be the first?" I said, "Yes, sir, Mr. President." I couldn't believe it. And he said, "I'll be looking forward to seeing you in Washington, D.C.
Amazing.
And I tell you, Pamela, I almost fell off of my seat. This was just a dream that came true. And so I came home, and I told my wife right away, that I met the president. I shook hands with the President Kennedy. She says, "You're lying." I said, "No, it's true. He invited me to Washington, D.C. She was about to call the boogie wagon for me.
She thought you'd lost it, right?
Yes, how fate, and providence brought us together. Well, on June 6th of 1961, I went to Washington, D.C. after the president's invitation, and I became the first African-American assigned to the White House detail as he had promised.
Amazing. Not even 2 months later, all of a sudden you were in D.C. taking on yet another first in your life.
That's right.
Just extraordinary. So again, I hear that you're excited, you're pleased to be working for your government, and more than pleased to be working with the President of the United States. You had some concerns, though, early on. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about the concerns that you had when you got to the White House. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I am talking with Abraham Bolden, author of The Echo from Dealey Plaza. We'll be right back. Hello again, folks. This is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk. And I'm having a conversation with Abraham Bolden, who was the first African-American on the White House Secret Service detail, and he worked with President John F. Kennedy. Mr. Bolden, in the weeks between your first meeting the president, President Kennedy, and actually going to Washington to be a part of the White House detail, were they investigating you? I mean, I start to think about, you know, the security check, and did they do a clearance on you, and what was going on in those 5 or 6 weeks?
Yes, well, I had already been cleared by the NSA and by the FBI before I became an agent of the United States Secret Service.
I see. Okay.
Yes, they went all the way back down to Mississippi where my father was born and grandfather, and they went through all of those records before I even became a Secret Service agent.
Would they go through records that far back for everyone?
Sure. I think that they would. Okay. I believe that they would.
Okay.
Yes.
So now you're in the United States. I mean, you're in Washington, D.C., the seat of power, in theory, for not only the United States, but for much of the world. I got to think that security was really tight there.
Well, I was very surprised at the security that the President Kennedy was getting. In the first place, you know, we were in the midst in 1961 of the revolutionary civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And there was conflict throughout the South and in many cases in the North. There were riots and lynchings, and there were voting rights demonstrations, there were freedom bus riots. So the climate was very, very separative. As I walked in the White House on June the 1st, there was a lot of racism and division within the United States of America. Now, I understood this, and I understood that I would have to be very cautious about my actions and what I said, what I did, because there were many people who were dissatisfied with the fact that I was going to the White House, and they were mostly my fellow agents in Chicago. And now, when I went to the White House, I was expecting some problems, but I was not expecting the amount of racism that I found in the agents, among the agents of the U.S. Secret Service. It seemed to me that they were very prejudiced. I interrupted a good old boys club, and I noticed that they were very hateful towards President Kennedy. They were saying some things about our President of the United States that I can't even repeat on the telephone. They were very dejected. Several of the members of the detail were very, very hateful against the President. They were calling him such names as nigger lovers and things like that. They just didn't like the president whatsoever because of the stance on civil rights and other matters that they were prejudiced against.
Well, it's kind of hard to imagine that somebody who has such a negative view of the president is actually going to take guarding the president's life and family seriously.
They didn't, and the only reason that they stayed there was for the money, because they got double money. You know, whenever the president travels and he leaves Washington, D.C., then they get a per diem. And so that puts them at a higher level of pay. But they were very, very, you might say, hateful against the president. They disliked him. And not all of the agents now. There were just a few, and it only takes one bad apple to
open
the door.
That's true.
Yes, well, these few agents had been raised in the South, and of course they didn't like me. One, especially Harvey Henderson, who was the assistant special agent in charge of my detail. Now, when the president went to Massachusetts, Annisport, Massachusetts, on about July the 1st of 1961, I traveled to Massachusetts with him. And the president treated me royally, by introducing me to his brother, his father, his mother, and almost everybody that was on the compound, he introduced me to the members of his family. Some agents took offense at that.
I see.
And,
okay.
And my supervisor, Harvey Henderson, hated it so bad, and he disliked it so bad that he, in the hotel room where we were living at little farmhouse outside of town, he told me that I was the N-word. I would always be nothing but an N-word, and to act like that I was an N-word.
Wow.
This was what he told me. Now,
And this was your supervisor?
Yes, and he was the supervisor within the Secret Service. Mm-hmm. Now, what I did, that didn't disturb me too much because I understood, you know, there's a difference of opinion, and I knew what time it was. But what did alarm me more than anything else is a conversation that I overheard, which was led by this same person who was telling the other agents, if that assassination attempt was made against President Kennedy, he wasn't going to react, and he would advise them to do the same.
What?
Now, yes, that's right. That's right. That he would not give his life for the President of the United States. Now, these is the supervisor. And he is talking with other agents who were in the proximity and in the room, saying that he would not protect the President, and he was advocating that they do the same.
What did you do? What did you do when you heard this?
Well, what I did, I waited until I got back to Washington, D.C., and I went straight into the chief's office, which U.E. Bauman was the chief of the Secret Service then, and I told him all of the experiences that I had endured, and specifically concerning the agents saying that they would not protect the President of the United States. I thought this was very serious and that they had so far lost focus so badly that they were individualizing the President of the United States instead of protecting the presidency of the United States, the constitutional office. And that's what we were there for, to make sure that the transition of the office is according to the Constitution of the United States, whether or not we like the individual who was in that office or not. But they seemed to take the attitude that the president was doing damaging things against the United States of America in the support of the racial equality, and the president had given many orders while he had been initiated as president. He had given orders that the federal organizations and that the federal jobs be proportioned to include Negroes who had been longtime employees of these agencies.
Mm-hmm.
And they really didn't like him for that. They say he was destroying the country by pushing this integration thing.
You know, Mr. Bolden, we hear the same kind of stuff today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Are you worried about the president today?
Yes, yes. I'm very concerned about him because in this atmosphere of President Obama can't do anything right. He, no matter if he sends troops into Iraq, he's wrong.
Right.
And if he pulls them out, he's wrong. If he goes into Syria, he's wrong. If he doesn't go into Syria, he's wrong. And not only that, the criticism is coming from high officials, and the amount of disrespect that our government officials are giving our president, it has not been fair and equal. I think that they're hard on President Obama because of his race, and that there are just don't want him to be successful.
So in many chilling kinds of ways, what you heard in the 60s is what you're hearing now at this time. When you reported to the supervisor what was going on as far as your experience of the people who were allegedly protecting the president, did he thank you for reporting this?
No, he didn't thank me, but he promised me that he would look into it.
And did he?
But at that time, I did not know that he was just about to retire within the next 30 days.
Okay.
And James Rowley took his place. James Rowley, who was in charge of the Secret Service detail, took U.E. Bauman's place as chief of the United States Secret Service. And so, The chief of the Secret Service, U.E. Bauman, had promised me that he was going to look into it because these were serious allegations that I was making. But when I did not hear or no one approached me in order to elucidate the allegations that I was making and to name names and give times and dates, then I began to complain again to the chief in Washington, D.C., and also the agents who were in charge of the Chicago office, because I asked to be relieved from the detail in July of 1961 because of the oppressive situation that I found myself in. But I found also that they were not investigating, and when the president came to Chicago on a couple of other occasions, I found that the agents were engaging in this same lackadaisical attitude, the drinking and the cabaret and the going on Rush Street and partying half of the night and then calling themselves protecting the President of the United States. So when the Chief Inspector Kelly came to Chicago, and this is the same Kelly that investigated the assassination in Dallas, Texas in 1963, when he came to Chicago, indicated to him that unless changes were made within the structure of the Secret Service agents who were surrounding the president, that the president's assassination would be a strong likelihood, because as I had told Chief Bauman, the Secret Service would not react if they were supposed to.
Did you see yourself at that point as something of a whistleblower? Because it sounds like you were. I mean, you found a problem, you were trying to go through channels, and doors were being shut in your face. Sometimes, it sounds like without you even being aware of it. Did you feel like you were in danger? Did you feel like you were a whistleblower?
Yes, I felt like I was a whistleblower, but I felt, because I had been reared with such high regard for the law, I felt like it was my duty. I felt like it was my responsibility that if I saw a weakness that was a danger to the Constitution of the United States or our democracy, that I should take some action. I really didn't look at myself as just blowing a whistle on anybody, because when I first went into police work, I was told about that thin blue line that you never cross, you never testify against another policeman, and this and that, you know, they have that little code of conduct.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought this was much larger. This was a much larger issue than just testifying against fellow agents. I felt that my obligation first was to the people of the United States and to my own individual conscience. And so that's why I took the direction that I took.
And it certainly was a courageous direction that ultimately landed you in some very ugly situations yourself. We're going to take a break, and when we return, more from Mr. Abraham Bolden, the first African-American on the White House Secret Service, a man of great courage and great strength. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Mr. Bolden, you all but heard a prediction that an attempt would be made on President Kennedy's life. And then when you shared that and went to many people trying to, it sounds like, secure the presidency and the president, what were you met with?
I was met with very stern warnings to so-called stay in my place, and it's not my business. I'm not the chief of the Secret Service. If I had anything to say, you know, just keep my mouth shut. I was met with all of those type of statements from supervisors within the Secret Service. However, after the president was assassinated, I was privy to a lot of assassination plots that were being hatched prior to the president was assassinated. And I noticed that none of this information was being gone before the Warren Commission, who was allegedly investigating the assassination.
What do you mean? What do you mean you were privy to a lot of the plots?
All right. There was a plot that was being hatched in Miami, Florida, where we had an informant who was in with an organization there headed by a man named Miltier. Now, we intercepted a telephone call between one of our informants and this activist who was a rightist from the South, from Birmingham, Alabama, and they were discussing how to assassinate President Kennedy over the telephone. And we had a recording of that. And our informant asked Miltier, well, how do you intend to carry this out? And he said that we're going to get the president from a tall building using a rifle with a telescopic sight on it. And this is exactly his words. And they said, well, we got to get around the Secret Service. And Miltier answered that, don't worry about the Secret Service. The more of those guys that are out there, the better off it's going to be. And we already have a guy who is set up as a patsy. All right, now we knew this prior to the president's assassination.
Extraordinary.
We also knew that here in Chicago, a member of the DRE, which was a Cuban organization, we had an informant inside that organization. And about late October of 1963, we had an informant who came back to us and reported to us, the Secret Service, that the president, that he had heard from this Echeverria, was the man's name, that the president was about to be assassinated. And he said that the president was going to be assassinated soon, and that the finance was going to come from the Jews, and that they were going to assassinate him so that President Johnson would be more agreeable to them going into Cuba and taking over Cuba than was President Kennedy. And we had this information documented. Now, after the president was assassinated, as I said, in reading the newspapers and looking at some of the information that was coming in to the Secret Service as who the witnesses were going to be before the Warren Commission, I noticed that the Secret Service was destroying a lot of reports. They were destroying materials. They were binding up materials and shipping it to Washington, D.C., to the chief of the Secret Service. And most of those reports that I inspected before, they were bundled up while they were on the desk of the secretary who was doing the shipping of the material. The reports were about the visits of President Kennedy. And I noticed that these reports were pertaining to the Echeverria case, pertaining to many of the cases that we had investigated in Chicago. And they were being dispatched to Washington, D.C. by a special courier. Now, when these men were not summoned before the Warren Commission, and we had a list of the people, the Secret Service had a list of people who were appearing before the Warren Commission.
Okay.
And I didn't see any of these names of the people that we were investigating who had definite knowledge of pre-plot to assassinate President Kennedy. I didn't see their names being called before the Warren Commission.
None of them.
None of them.
Huh.
And And as a result, I'm thinking as a young man, I say, well, it could be that the Secret Service are trying to cover up these things, and it would be my duty and my obligation to alert the Warren Commission that there was more extensive evidence that would indicate that Oswald may or may not have been the lone gunman.
And did you get an opportunity to do that?
Well, I had expressed an intention to do that, and I think that intention that I confided with to another agent, I think that he went in and told the supervisor here in Chicago. So when I went to Washington, D.C. on May the 17th of 1963, I was to attend the Secret Service school, but prior to going to school, I tried to contact one of the chief counsels of the Warren Commission to solicit him to call me as a witness before the Warren Commission in order that I could give the information.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next morning, the chief of the Secret Service and the inspector of the Secret Service checked me out of the hotel on a pretext that I was needed back in Chicago for an investigation of counterfeiting in Villa Park. Now, Villa Park is an all-white suburb here just outside of Chicago, and I knew better. I was just...
Okay.
I didn't know what they were going to do, but I did know that I was in deep trouble when they came to me with that lie.
Okay, and you knew it was a lie. At some point, you knew that was a lie. It didn't make sense to you.
Yes, that's right. That's right. When they would not give me permission after we landed in Chicago, when they would not give me permission to call my wife or consult anybody outside of the courthouse where they were holding me, I knew that there was something up, and it was not good for me. Now, Inspector McCann, who had accompanied me from Washington, D.C., he kept telling me, talking to me as we were waiting out. I waited there from 1 o'clock in the afternoon all the way up into 12 midnight. Now, he kept,
And you were actually in the courthouse, in a courthouse?
Yes, in the courthouse, in the federal courthouse in Chicago, Illinois.
Okay.
They didn't let me eat. They didn't let me drink water. The temperature outside was about 93 degrees, and they had all the windows down. In the process, they asked me if I would take a polygraph examination. Now, I knew why that they would want me to do that, because if that they indeed had any suspicions of me committing any type of crime, everybody would expect them to give me a polygraph examination.
Oh,
so
I
that
see.
Was just a formality. You understand what
I do.
I'm saying?
And it sounds like at some point they really just gave up the nonsense about needing you to do work. It was clear that they were coming after you for something, but you didn't know what.
Yes, that's right. And the giveaway was when Inspector McCann told me during one of the interviews that you are not a team player, and we're not going to stand by and let you, screw up our retirement. We have many years in the Secret Service, and boy, you're not going to mess it up. So that let me know right away what this thing was all about.
And how old were you at that time?
I was about 28 years old.
28 years old.
Yes, 28 years old.
And if they had allowed you to tell what you knew, it could have changed the course of the United States history in a way that they just didn't want to have happen.
Absolutely, because they would have had to talk with people, subpoena people who had firsthand knowledge that the president was going to be assassinated, the method and means that would be used prior to his going to Dallas, Texas.
And yeah, what I want to make clear to the listeners is that what we're talking about is not a fabrication. It's not your ideas about what could be true. What we're talking about is your life and what actually happened to you.
That's right. Absolutely. That's exactly what happened to me. Now at midnight on the 18th of May, they served a warrant on me and charged me with soliciting of bribes, conspiracy, and who they used in order to testify against me. One of the men, Frank Jones, I had arrested twice. I had a case pending on him for counterfeiting of United States money. The second man that they had used to testify against me was a Joseph Spagnoli. He also was under criminal indictment for the passing of bogus $100 bonds. And so they made a deal with Frank Jones that if he would say certain things concerning me, that they would drop his case along with 16 other defendants whom I had arrested along with Frank Jones, and that's exactly what happened. Now, the odd thing is that when I went to trial before Judge J. Sam Perry on July the 12th of 1964, Judge Perry, during the deliberation of the jury, called the jury out and told the jury, in my opinion, the defendant is guilty of all charges of the indictment.
Okay, wait. Right. That doesn't happen. We know that. I mean, I watch enough court TV. That kind of stuff doesn't happen. The judge is impartial. The judge is not there to give his or her opinion. They are there to make sure that the law is followed in the presentation of a case. So surely what you're saying can't possibly have happened.
Oh, yes, it happened. And my attorney and I were very shocked. The judge said, in my opinion, the defendant is guilty of counts 1, 2, and 3 of the indictment. And he told them that they could disagree with him if they wanted to, but now go back in and deliberate with the information that I just gave you. So now he became a 13th juror.
Absolutely. Actually, he became 1 through 13.
Yes, he did, because the power that he has as a federal judge, you know, was very influential on the jury, but they didn't find me guilty. That jury, the case was so weak, even that jury didn't find me guilty. So the second trial, starting in August the 3rd of 1964, this same judge heard a second trial. He refused to recuse himself, saying that he was not prejudiced against the defendant, who was me.
Okay, my mouth is just dropped open. I mean, how do you tell somebody that this guy is guilty, but no, I'm not prejudiced, so let me just preside over the, and they let somebody let him get away with that.
Yes,
so there were a lot of people who were involved in, quite frankly, throwing you under a few buses.
Yes, that's right.
Mr. Bolden,
during the second trial.
Mr. Bolden, I'm just going to ask you if we can take a break, and we will be right back. I don't want to miss any part of what you've experienced.
All right.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll return in a moment. And we're back, folks. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and we're continuing the conversation with Abraham Bolden. It's a true and really unnerving and despicable story of what Mr. Bolden went through as he was trying to do his job as a member of the Secret Service. Mr. Bolden, there was a second trial.
Yes, there was a second trial that began on August the 3rd before the same judge who had told the previous jury that he thought that I was guilty and to vote on the information that he had just given them. So during the second trial, the jury began to deliberate on August 11th of 1964. The judge, at the conclusion of the evidence, said that it was getting late, that he was going to go home for the night, he was tired, and he emptied the courtroom of me, my attorney, my family, and other spectators who were in the courtroom. The only people who were left inside the court building, they locked us out of the court building. The only people who were in there were FBI agents, Secret Service agents. I think there were a couple of members of the CIA, and there was the United States attorney. They were all government employees that were inside of the building, locked up with the jury. Of course, on August the 12th, they found me guilty.
Wait a second. The judge said that he was going to shut it down for the day because he was going home. And then you folks got locked out? And did he go home or did he stay and talk to the jury?
No,
what happened?
Apparently he didn't, because on my way home myself on the Dan Ryan Expressway, before I got home and I heard a flash over the radio that the jury had just reached a decision and the judge had released the jury.
This is just getting uglier and uglier.
Yes, it was for me and my wife, too. I understood the gravity of the situation, so I had to begin to prepare for the worst. And that's what I began to do by hiring certain attorneys in different locations where I knew that there was a possibility that the government would try to declare me insane or out of my mind, or they would take some stern action to eliminate me and my conversation, and that's exactly what happened after I had been incarcerated at Terre Haute, Indiana. They sent me from Terre Haute to Fort Leavenworth, and from Fort Leavenworth, I was incarcerated at the Federal Medical Center in Springfield, Missouri in 1967. Now, that particular institution, Springfield Medical Center, is four institutions in one. They assigned me to the camp, the federal prison camp. Mm-hmm. There's also the hospital there. There's a psychiatric ward. And then it's also a transportation center for the transportation of inmates from one institution to another. But they assigned me to the camp. Well, I knew and I had prepared. Prepared to take action in case that they tried to declare me insane, and that's exactly what they did. At 3 o'clock in the morning, it was about 3:33 in the morning, and this happened on July the 6th, 1967. They came and got me out of my bunk, out of the camp, and they marched me over to the psychiatric ward, forced me to take psychotropic drugs, and held me there for 30 days with the intent of declaring me insane.
Mr. Bolden, I got to ask you, during all of this, you had a wife and you had a family. You had children, yes?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I had a wife and family, a very diligent wife. As a matter of fact, had not she been so loyal to me, I don't think I could have made it, but by her visiting and keeping tabs on what they were doing to me, and with people like Mark Lane also consulting with my wife as to my welfare, I think that's really what pulled me through so far as the material is concerned. But also I had a very deep spiritual feeling about this thing, and that's where I came out of it, as I explained in the echo from Dita Plaza.
So many families have been through, as you know, unfortunately, have been through not what you've gone through, but similar things where somebody in the family has been arrested or charged with something, and those families can often fall apart. Many families don't, but there are certainly families that do. It's a terrible burden, not only on the union between the two core family members, but it's a burden on the extended family, on children if there are any. What was it about your relationship with your wife? What was it about the woman your wife was and the children that you reared that allowed you all to stay intact during such horrific times?
Well, one thing, my wife and I grew up together in East St. Louis, Illinois. We went to grade school together, high school together, and we also were family friends. And she was a very, as I said, dutiful wife, but she did suffer greatly. She suffered greatly when I went away. But it was just, you know, God works in mysterious ways. He gives you what you need even before you need it. And that's why he matched me up with this wonderful girl, Barbara Harding, who was, as I said, passed on in 2005. And we were married for 49 years.
Amazing.
Of course, my children did suffer because there were some things they had to be denied because of my absence. However, I have a son now who is a Ph.D., who is also the assistant, you might say, administrator of the business school at Florida A&M University.
Wonderful.
Yes, I have a daughter that retired after about 35 years as a human relations secretary for Commonwealth Edison Electric Company. And my middle son, my oldest son, Abram, worked for the Chicago School Board. He's a computer technician. So you can see not only did my wife stand by me, but she guided my children to a great education, and they're all successful in this day and time.
And it's extraordinary just to think of so much that's gone on. And there's so much more of your story to tell that we're not going to get to in this hour. I'm wondering if I can impose upon you to come back and talk to us again very soon.
Sure. I'd be grateful to.
Wonderful. But before we go, let me just, I just sort of want to put a comma, if you will, on this part of your life. You entered into service, you were late 20s, and by the time you were 30, instead of your life still being ahead of you and with glorious opportunities, which one would have thought, you had been found guilty of 3 trumped up charges, and you had been sentenced. What was your sentence on the charges?
6 years.
Six years.
6 years in the penitentiary, and I did 3 years and 3 months.
And those 6 years and those 3 years and 3 months were some horrific times in your life. You mentioned the name Mark Lane. Remind our audience who Mark Lane is.
Mark Lane is a researcher. He's one of the first researchers that questioned the validity of the conclusion of the Warren Commission. As a matter of fact, shortly after Kennedy was assassinated, Mark Lane wrote several books concerning the assassination and did a marvelous investigation, which came to the conclusion that the Warren Commission was wrong and that there was indeed a conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy.
Which, in fact, you had reported before it happened.
Yes, that's right.
I am going to be coming back to you to talk more about what those experiences were like in prison and your life after you were finally able to get out. But just in closing today, what I would like for you to comment on, if you would, is where we are in the world today. Because again, as you and I said a little while ago, the times have changed, but the times are the same. In terms of the president that we have, the president who you were trying to protect, President Kennedy, many people opposed John F. Kennedy. Many people oppose Barack Obama. What do you want us as a people to think about today?
Well, I would like for people to think about love and brotherhood today. Now, we're going to go through a critical time, which we're at a critical juncture now. There will be attempts to assassinate President Obama. It's no question about that. It's not a matter of if, but it's a matter of when, because he's there. 50% of the population now believes that he's not doing an adequate job, and there's another 47% that would rather see him dead than president. Now, so we're at a critical time in America now, and it's going to take level-headed people, God-fearing people with understanding and wisdom in order to come through this. And I hope that I would be one to spur this type of action to bring the people together. And I'm studying to do that now.
Well, Mr. Bolden, we will be having you back very shortly, and we will continue our dialogue. And we will talk more about what it is that you would like to accomplish today.
Yes, I
do thank you so much for your time today. Abraham Bolden, author of The Echo from Dealey Plaza, and an echo indeed, a reverberation throughout much of a lifetime. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you have been listening to Mind Talk. Thank you for listening to this edition. Make sure you tune in for part two of this conversation with Mr. Bolden. You can also listen to Mind Talk on demand at www.myndtalk.org. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. They come together to produce Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. Today's producer, Bernie Simpson, the social media coordinator, Courtney Ebu. Thank you all very much for your participation in today's program. Mind Talk is provided as an daily educational public service and is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can dial 301-654-5286. But the best way to be in touch is to go to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And please always remember, if it is unacceptable, then that is exactly and precisely what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.